Coming up on the Down East Journal, minor league baseball is back in Eastern North Carolina as opening day for the new Down East Wood Ducks is less than 2 months away. We have a feature on the historical impact of baseball from the city of Kinston and new hopes for success after a six-season drought without a team to call its own.
They'll come in early, they'll travel to local businesses or maybe some of the historical sites. They'll come in, they'll spend the day.
Also, proposed shrimp trawling limits move forward at the coast.
If it is found that the economic impact would be in excess of $1 million, it's going to require regulatory impact analysis. And we do anticipate that the economic impact would be in excess of $1 million.
And a new statewide study, the largest mammal survey of its kind, is already underway here in Eastern North Carolina.
You get to see all these animals, these candid pictures. But then what we do from the scientific point of view is we basically take these pictures and turn them into numbers.
That's coming your way on the Down East Journal. This spring, the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries and the North Carolina Coastal Federation are partnering on a 15-acre oyster restoration project near the Pamlico Sound. An oyster reef will be constructed at the 40-acre Swan Island Oyster Sanctuary in the mouth of the South River. Steve Murphy is the section chief of the Habitat and Enhancement Section with the division. He says the $1.2 million project is paid for by state funds and a grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
We met with the Coastal Federation to partner with them on a NOAA grant that they were applying for and ultimately received. And what this does is it leverages existing state money that we were given by the legislature in last year's session for oyster enhancement. And it really it doubles the amount of effort we're going to be able to do. So we're real excited about that opportunity.
The Division of Marine Fisheries manages 14 oyster sanctuaries, primarily throughout the Pamlico Sound. This week, I spoke with coastal scientist and regional manager with the North Carolina Coastal Federation's Northeast Office, Aaron Fleckenstein, about the reef construction and the goal to enhance oyster habitat along our coast.
So oyster reefs have been on the decline worldwide since the late 1800s, early 1900s. As a worldwide statistic, we're at about 15% of our historic oyster populations. Here in North Carolina, we know that our harvest is the best indication of the population size that we have, and it's about 20% of our historic peak harvest. So there's been a sort of worldwide effort to restore and protect oyster reefs because of their many benefits.
This project is part of an ambitious goal to restore 50 million oysters in North Carolina waters by 2020. Tell me about that goal and that project.
Yeah, we've set this goal as a way to coalesce all of our partners and set the vision for our desire to restore oyster reefs. And a large part of it will take place in Pamlico Sound around our oyster sanctuary work that we partner with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries on.
Now, this spring, North Carolina Coastal Federation and partners will be breaking ground on a 15-acre oyster restoration project. Tell me about that project.
We're doing it in a public-private partnership, working with a local North Carolina marine contractor who will actually be building the reef for us. We started receiving our full truckloads of material for the reef and culch planting. There will be 8 truck drivers every day bringing approximately 4 loads of material to the South River stockpile location, and that material will sit there until weather conditions allow the contractor to take the material out to the reef site.
So the new reef going in at Swan Island Oyster Sanctuary, can you tell me about that location, where it's at, and how big is it?
So this is a newly permitted site. It's sited in relatively shallow water, in about 12 feet of water.
What will it look like? What is the design and the layout?
Well, it won't be visible from the air. You'll have to scuba dive in order to be able to see it. But it will be sort of ridges of marl, which is a rock material, limestone rock material, that will be deployed from a barge, and it will create these ridges underwater where oyster larvae will naturally recruit to them and attach to the limestone marl and grow up into adult oysters, helping to restore oyster reefs to our waters.
inside these sanctuaries, will commercial fishermen be able to harvest oysters from them eventually?
These sanctuaries are not designed for commercial harvest of oysters. They're designed to really provide a nursery area for oysters in our sounds to restore that lost population that will then help to seed areas that are open to harvest. These sanctuaries are working hand in glove with nearby culch planted sites. And the culch planted sites are built in a similar fashion, but using smaller material, and they will be open to harvest once oysters get to legal size.
That's Aaron Fleckenstein, the coastal scientist and regional manager with the North Carolina Coastal Federation, talking about the partnership with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries to build a 15-acre oyster reef near the Pamlico Sound. Thanks, Aaron, for speaking with me.
Okay, thanks, Jared.
According to the Division of Marine Fisheries, shrimp are the second most economically important fishery in North Carolina. In communities like Englehart, Lowland, Hoboken, and down East Carteret County, many commercial fishermen make their living trawling for shrimp in the Pamlico Sound. That's why a petition to reclassify most internal waters is a contentious topic right now. At a public hearing last Thursday in Wilmington, the North Carolina Fisheries Commission voted 5-3 to grant a petition for rulemaking that, if adopted, would limit shrimp trawling in most North Carolina waters. Proponents say the changes would greatly reduce bycatch and help bolster populations of commercially valuable finfish. Those against the measure say it will raise the price of locally caught shrimp and could decimate the shrimping industry in North Carolina. Jerry Schill is the president of the North Carolina Fisheries Association, a nonprofit organization that lobbies local, state, and federal policymakers on behalf of commercial fishermen.
It was not surprising to us, but very disappointing, because after you come off an advisory committee meeting in New Bern, where the five advisory committees voted overwhelmingly to recommend that the commission reject the petition or deny the petition, then they went ahead and accepted it anyway, was very disappointing.
The petition, submitted November 2nd by the North Carolina Wildlife Federation and modified on January 12th, asks the commission to designate all coastal fishing waters, not otherwise designated as nursery areas, including the Atlantic Ocean out to 3 miles from shore, as special secondary nursery areas. It also seeks to establish clear criteria for the opening of shrimp season and define the type of gear and how and when gear may be used in special secondary nursery areas during shrimp season. Since the meeting, advisor with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, David Knight, says he's received a positive response from people who feel the recommendations are a step in the right direction.
North Carolina's management of its marine fisheries has been status quo for a long time. And while other states modernized their management practices, upgraded their management practices, North Carolina has not.
Knight says their goal with the petition requests is to reduce the amount of juvenile fish that are caught as bycatch as commercial fishermen drag their nets through the water. Increasing the populations of croaker, spot, and weakfish would benefit commercial and recreational fishermen, as well as help improve the diversity of the ecosystem.
Change is hard, and moving away from status quo is difficult, and we understand that. But for the hundreds of millions of juvenile fish that we're losing every year to shrimp trawling, we believe, the majority of the people in North Carolina believe, that we need to change our management system and change our management style and upgrade it and make it more in line with what other states have done.
Knight says the requests outlined in the proposal are not meant to shut down the shrimping industry in the state, adding they're trying to balance conservation efforts with the shrimping industry's needs.
Even with these recommendations that the Wildlife Federation put forward, we'd still be the most lenient state in the Southeast Coast and Gulf Coast when it comes to shrimp trawling.
Even though the petition doesn't seek to ban shrimping from taking place, North Carolina Fisheries Association President Jerry Schill says it would cut the industry by 60-70%. He says fewer fishermen operating would drive up the price of locally caught shrimp.
It no longer makes it economically feasible for some of the fish buyers or shrimp buyers to invest in the infrastructure, and some of your smaller boats won't have docking facilities anymore.
With commercial fishermen having to navigate more stringent restrictions limiting where, when, and how shrimp can be caught, Schill says the supply of local shrimp would dwindle.
So the immediate effect would be if the supply was diminished, then it would simply be replaced with foreign imports. And I don't think the folks in eastern North Carolina and the tourists that come here would put up with that for long.
On the other hand, David Knight with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation says they believe the proposed regulations, if approved, would have little to no negative effects and could actually yield some gains for the shrimping industry.
One of the recommendations is for basically to have a size of the shrimp before the season opens, for the shrimp to get to a certain size. That adds value to the shrimp in terms of the fishermen, and it also adds quality to the shrimp as well. So if folks are looking for North Carolina caught shrimp, it will still be plenty of that out there.
Knight adds the commercial fishing industry as a whole would benefit from the change in shrimping regulations because of the reduction in bycatch. Commercially valuable finfish would become more plentiful. These issues, as well as the economic impact of the requests outlined in the petition, will be examined further as the North Carolina Fisheries Commission continues their rulemaking process. Public Information Officer for the Division of Marine Fisheries, Patricia Smith, says the development of a fiscal note is required before a notice of text for the proposed rules can be published in the North Carolina Register.
If it is found that the economic impact would be in excess of $1 million, it's going to require regulatory impact analysis, and we do anticipate that the economic impact would be in excess of $1 million.
That process could take more than a year to complete and must be approved by the Office of State Budget and Management and the Commission before the notice of text can be published. Then, Smith says, a public comment period and hearing will be held before they can consider final adoption of the rules.
Some of the proposed rules might require modification of existing fishery management plans before they can be adopted. It's really kind of unclear now exactly how the rules and the fishery management plans are going to play in with each other.
If the commission adopts the rules, they will go before the State Rules Review Commission for approval before taking effect. However, if the state receives 10 letters of objection, the issue will automatically move to the legislature. David Knight with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation says they will work with the state to make sure the shrimping regulations take effect.
We look forward to working with the commission and with the stakeholders and the public as we move forward in this rulemaking process. And if there needs to be some tweaks or small changes to it, we're willing to have that conversation.
On the other side of the debate, North Carolina Fisheries Association President Jerry Schill says they are focusing on educating the public and commercial fishermen on the rulemaking process.
A lot of people, fishermen and others, when are you going to sue? Well, it's premature to do that. They didn't actually adopt rules. They just adopted a process. So it's premature to do litigation, but there's a lot of other things that can be done, including getting the public to understand what the issue is and taking shrimp off their table and that sort of thing.
For more information on the North Carolina Wildlife Federation's proposal and the rulemaking process, go to our website, www.publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. On April 3rd, the Downeast Wood Ducks will host Mount Olive College in their first exhibition game in their new home, Granger Stadium. The 68-year-old venue has been a mainstay in Kinston's culture and will house its first professional franchise since the Indians left following the 2011 season. It will be the continuation of a long tradition after a relatively brief interruption. Chris Thomas has this.
For 6 years, this was the sound at Granger Stadium. Outside of a few amateur games and non-sporting events, it stood silent and unoccupied. This is how it sounds now. A large excavator pulling up land where the expanded parking lot is expected to be, pressure washers running from the inside, cleaning the grandstands, revealing its dark green paint once more. The stadium will host the Freedom Classic Series between the Air Force and Naval Academies this weekend, but the first home game for the expansion Downeast Wood Ducks is a little more than a month away. It comes as minor league baseball's attendance rises across the nation. A Forbes magazine article stated the Miners had the third best year of attendance in its history last year, and their 20 most valuable teams alone drew in $37.5 million.
minor league baseball is sort of the hottest thing going in America now, and to have it back in our own backyard is just means so much to everybody.
Bill Ellis is Kinston's Parks and Recreation Director. The city owns Granger Stadium and has recently invested more than $1.6 million in getting it ready for the Wood Ducks. The team is part of the Texas Rangers minor league system and a member of the Single-A Carolina League, which includes teams in Wilmington, Winston-Salem, and the Mudcats of Zebulon, the team that used to be the Kinston Indians. According to Ellis, the money for the repairs came from funds the city already had and didn't require an increase on taxes.
Now, we were very fortunate. We had borrowed some money about 10 years ago to renovate the stadium, and we've got that all paid off. So we were able just to keep our loan payment at the same amount to make these renovations. So taxes, we will not see a tax increase.
Renovations to the stadium will take place over the course of two seasons. This year, about $750,000 is being spent on expanding the stadium's parking lot, installing a new concession stand, construction on a new team locker room, and new lights. It will be the revival of a long-standing regional tradition. The past 6 years have been the longest drought the city's experienced since Granger Stadium was built in 1949. Ellis moved to the city in 1979 and has fond memories of the old Indians team that left town after the 2011 season.
We knew a tradition was coming to the end. When we saw that last out, it was sort of a sick feeling at your stomach knowing that you probably would never see another professional baseball game here.
The Indians were independently owned, but the new team was born in expansion and belongs to the Arlington, Texas-based American League club.
Quite frankly, I think the reason we got it back is because this is a team-owned ball team. So the Texas Rangers actually own this franchise, and they're looking to develop young talent and get them up to the big leagues.
Kinston has had multiple teams since the 1900s, but many of them went by the nickname Eagles. Those teams went in and out of the Major League farm system starting in the 1950s, when they became a Boston Red Sox affiliate. During that era, when the Eagles were a Yankees affiliate, one of the team's biggest events came on April 3, 1973, when the Yankees and Mets squared off following spring training. The game featured Hall of Famer Willie Mays in his last season, but the star of the night was Rom Bloomberg, a former Eagle who hit the game-winning single and put the Yankees on top 6-5. In the early 1980s, Ellis said the team generated more than $2 million, but then it ran into some hard times until the end of the decade.
And then we had a local ownership group headed up by Cam McCray that bought the team just to keep it in Kinston. They kept it here for 23 wonderful years with the Cleveland Indians. We at that time had the longest relationship with a minor league team.
Now, minor league baseball is back with a new name, the Wood Ducks, a breed native to eastern North Carolina that came back from the verge of extinction in the early 20th century. Paul Mixner was hoping the team would take on the Eagles moniker. He's the manager of Hawk Sauce Company on Queen Street, about a mile and a half away from the stadium, and would have liked the nickname related to his shop. Regardless, he's glad someone's occupying Granger Stadium after the Indians' departure.
We lost that impact. Tax dollar-wise, I don't know. You know, I never really looked into what it did, but this has to be a plus for the city. Since the city owns the stadium, it's nice to know the rent's kind of getting paid.
Mixner believes the new team could have a positive impact on the town's commercial district along Queen Street.
You know, I don't know that the Indian farm team drew a tremendous amount of people, but when the people were here, they'll come in early, they'll travel to local businesses, whether it be, or maybe some of the historical sites, they'll come in, they'll spend the day, maybe even the weekend if it's a multi-day tournament.
Most of the employment promised by baseball's return is seasonal. According to Bill Ellis, the team is expected to generate $3.5 to $4 million for the community at large. Ultimately, baseball's future impact on Kinston will be decided one ticket and one game at a time. I'm Chris Thomas.
Spring is just around the corner, although the weather this week may lead you to believe it's already here. Since the warmer temperatures cause bears, foxes, deer, and other mammals in eastern North Carolina to become more active, now is the perfect time to take part in a massive camera trapping project to help uncover the secrets of local wildlife. Today, Mac McKee speaks with biologist at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and NC State University, Roland Kays, about the statewide project, the largest ever mammal survey of its kind.
Mr. Case, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you explain how the North Carolina Candid Critters Project works?
Yeah, sure. So the Candid Critters Project is an effort to collaborate with the citizens of the state to get a better idea about the wildlife populations across the state by running camera traps. And these are motion-sensitive cameras that we're asking people to help us put out there in the woods, in the state parks, in the game lands, in the national parks, even in some backyards to see what animals are out there. And basically, when an animal walks by, the camera will take pictures of the animals and save it to a memory card. And our volunteers that run the cameras, they look at the pictures themselves and then share them with us so that we can sort of count them up from all 100 counties across the state and start to make comparisons and sharing, of course, some of the best pictures and the results as well.
Now, sampling in eastern North Carolina has been underway, but when did it start here in the east and how many counties are participating so far?
We started earlier this year. We started in December in the east, so we had a winter sampling in the east, and we've got, it looks like, 136 uploads already, so that means 136 people have run a camera, taken the pictures, and shared them with us, and we're just going through them now and starting to share some of the best pictures on our websites, and we're looking to start again in the spring. I think we've had about a half or three quarters of the county so far represented, but like I said, we're kind of just getting geared up now, so we're looking forward to getting some more complete coverage so we can really make comparisons across these counties.
This is a three-year project. The goal, as I understand it, is to monitor 20 to 30,000 sites in all of North Carolina counties. How are you going to use those photographs and the information from the camera traps?
Yeah, so, you know, the photographs are super fun, and you get to see all these animals, these candid pictures of deer and bear and, you know, other animals like coyotes and foxes that are or bobcats that are hard to see sometimes. And so, you know, the photographs we definitely like to share and spread around and, you know, let everyone get this kind of unique view of our state's animals. But then what we do from the scientific point of view is we basically take these pictures and turn them into numbers, you know, the number of deer photographed in this place or that place. And those we can start to analyze in a number of ways to look at the compare the populations of animals that live in different states at different times. And start to understand what affects those populations. And the North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission is a key partner here, and they're very interested in getting this more detailed picture of the wildlife in the state to help manage and conserve the species.
Is there a particular species that you're hoping to collect more information about?
Well, we're really interested in everything. Basically, the nice thing about these camera traps is they get pictures of all kinds of different animals, you know, from chipmunks on up to black bear and elk. And so, you know, in the east, there's some particularly interesting dynamics. There's you know, seem to be some very healthy black bear populations, so we're certainly interested in them. Seems to be a growing coyote population, and how they're impacting the deer herd is one of the questions that we're very interested in. And then the red wolf population seems to be on the decline, and if that, you know, continues, we'd like to be able to document that, and then to see, you know, what's the impact, if that happens, on the other species, like, you know, will coyotes expand a ton with the absence of the wolf, or will the deer population change? So looking at some of these sort of effects across all these different species will be super interesting to see.
Now, when did you start these camera trap studies, or is this in the last year the first time you've attempted it?
Oh, no, I've been running cameras since back in the days of film when, you know, you'd get 36 pictures and you'd have to go change the roll of film. So we've been doing this for a while, but just recently we teamed with the Smithsonian Institution to create the infrastructure, basically the website and the database that allow us to collect these millions and millions of pictures. I mean, we've already got, just this first winter, we've got 75,000 pictures that have been uploaded from eastern North Carolina. So that can get overwhelming if you don't have a proper system set up to manage that. And that's what we've done over the last couple years. And so we have been working with citizen scientists, with volunteers running cameras, for the last 3 or 4 years, and that work, we worked with a few hundred people, that kind of emboldened us to say, we could scale this up and get even a better view of a larger area and work with really thousands of people. So that's our goal for this new project.
As far as camera itself, how are they available to residents? How can they get a hold of one?
Sure. Well, we can work either way. If you own your own camera, you can use that as long as it's a certain subset of brands. We also have cameras that we're loaning out across the state. So we're working with 38 libraries across the state. And you can, once you've taken our training on our website, we have an online training, so you make sure you know how to run the camera trap and how to set it the way we like to set it. Then you'll be able to check one out from a library, and so you can get it and run it. We ask you to check it out for a season, so for like the spring season or the summer season, and move it around a couple times. So usually we ask you to put it in one place, strap it to a tree for 3 weeks, come back, change the memory card, move it to another place in the same area, and then upload the pictures to us while you're waiting for the next deployment to finish its 3 weeks.
Now, how many volunteers are needed during the course of the program?
Definitely thousands of volunteers will be needed across the state, because we're really trying to get a good look at all the counties. So it's 100 counties in North Carolina. It's really fun to see these animals that are living, you know, around you, and to get this unique view of these species like bears and coyotes and bobcats that are, you know, hard to see with your own two eyes.
Mr. Case, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Well, thanks for having me and helping us get the word out to your listeners.
Be on the lookout for wildlife here in eastern North Carolina and in your own backyard. Today on the Garden Journal, we discuss what to do when you encounter baby bunnies, also called kittens, when preparing your spring garden.
We have a special guest today, Tony O'Neill, the founder of Possumwood Acres Wildlife Sanctuary. Tony is a state and federally licensed wildlife rehabilitator. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Is the time of year that people are getting out in the garden, they're cutting back those grasses, cleaning up the brush piles, and they may be coming across nests of baby rabbits. So, Tony, can you explain to us how mother rabbits raise their babies and why people come across so many nests that seem to be abandoned?
This causes us a problem every year. Because in the spring, as you said, everybody's trying to get their gardens ready. And this is the perfect time for the mother rabbits to find a nest under all of that. They will look for something under a big scraggly bush. They'll look in a big brush pile. Frequently what happens is you discover this little pile of baby bunnies that look adorable. But you're like, oh my goodness, now what? Well, a lot of people think that they have been abandoned, that they have scared the mother off. And that's usually not the case. The rabbits have kind of a different raising their baby style, and they only come to their baby's nest twice a day. They're going to come before the sun comes up, and they're going to come back again after the sun goes down. And so people think that the mother has left the babies alone. So what we usually do is the first thing when people call and say, oh my, I've discovered a nest of baby bunnies, is tell them to just leave them there, sprinkle some stuff back over the nest so that the babies are covered and protected, and then you want to mark that nest. And then wait. See if the mom comes back. And if it's been disturbed, then yes, mom is taking care of her babies, and they are not abandoned.
Can somebody raise baby bunnies on their own, or what do they need to do?
Well, first off, the laws in North Carolina say you cannot have any wildlife without the proper permits. But the other thing is that baby rabbits don't do well in captivity. We try very, very, very hard to let the mama rabbits raise their own, because once those baby rabbits come into us for rehabilitative care for us to try and raise them, their survival rate's going to drop.
If somebody has a baby bunny that's maybe been brought to them by their dog or by their cat, or that little animal is obviously injured in some way, what should they do then?
Then they have to bring the animal to us. The baby bunny has to come in and get some care. If they even think their cat may have been involved in finding it, we do put the rabbit automatically on antibiotics rather than choose wrong, not give it the medication, and then have it die from the interaction with the cat. And it's very easy to miss if the cat picks something up in its mouth, and it's very easy to miss a little tiny tooth prick or a claw prick that went in and may have transferred bacteria. With the dogs, it's more of we worry about internal injuries, even though people tell me their dog has a very soft mouth when it picked it up. The bunny is even softer, so it doesn't take much at all to squish a little baby bunny and do some damage internally on it.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Lisa. I do appreciate being able to help educate people about the little bunnies that are out there.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend.